Testing. Okay. Okay. So, any questions? Maybe some of you already checked this website about NanoHub for the courses of course materials. So far, I only see two lecture notes. I didn't find any update about the breathing yet. So please be patient. Okay, I think they need some time also to synchronize the lecture notes with audio. So. Please check back soon, and I think they will have more updates this week. Okay. And also, there will be a homework assignment today. And because we had a long weekend, so this new homework will be due by next Monday. Okay. Please check back later today. It will be posted on the Compass website. All right, so now let's start our new lecture today, which we'll really be starting to talk about how we use the picture of the different carriers based on the knowledge we learned about interactions, about energy, about really the population of different carriers. And now let's try to build up really the transport pictures. So first of all, let's still quickly revisit some of the materials taught in the last lecture. The first thing I want to remind you of is the Boltzmann distribution, and particularly when you apply Boltzmann distribution onto particles that are of quantum mechanical nature, for example electrons, there is a Pauli exclusion law, right? And this Pauli exclusion law tells us that electrons, the possibilities of finding electrons below the so-called Fermi level is almost one. Okay, at a temperature, a relatively low temperature compared with that of the so-called Fermi level. Okay, and above that, the possibility of finding such a electron particle is diminished. On the other hand, if we look at photons and phonons, which are so-called bosons, Bose-Einstein distribution tells us that they like to aggregate, they like to really accumulate up at relatively lower energy density state, energy state. Okay, so the possibility of finding the particles at for example, near zero temperature range will be very high, particularly when the overall temperature of this of the system is low. Then you will have almost like a delta function type of thing, okay, for the population of phonons and photons. Okay, we're going to use that again today. So. The other thing we also mentioned last time was how fast do those particles move. Okay? It is sometimes rather surprising because our general impression is that the motion of a gas, for example, is really relatively slow. Okay, but in the case of individual atoms, when we estimate the traveling speed, we find that they really move individually at the speed almost faster than sound. So we're talking about 1,000 meter per second in the typical case of a gas. Okay, when it comes to the vibration of atoms in a lattice, the sound speed that we are looking at also is in the similar order of magnitude. Okay, 1,000 meter or a few 1,000 meter per second is the speed of a carrier that we are looking at, and of course it is actually a function of temperature. The higher the temperature, the faster they move. Okay, And the last thing that we covered last time was the interaction. Okay, how those different carriers interact with each other. For example, we talk about how photons interact with materials, and particularly with bound ions. Okay, and we found that you can really use a so-called oscillator model to describe how a bulk material or a lattice respond to electromagnetic waves based on the so-called molecular polarizability, and we find the so-called permittivity of a medium actually shows a frequency dependence, and this frequency is centered around really the oscillating frequency of individual basically atoms or ions or different carriers that are involved. So the heavier the carrier, the lower this central frequency is, right? So if we want to observe anything that is really significant for the typical case of visible light or infrared light, then we have to look for really the so-called plasmons or phonon polaritons. Okay, phonon polaritons really involves the motion, relative motion of two dislike atoms. So, and we talk about this also in the context of the surface excitation. In the case of bulk excitation, frequency of excitation is lower than the resonant frequency of the individual atoms or carriers, then it seems like we are rejecting energy out of the material, right? But in the case of a surface excitation, we see it allows something that is propagating only at the interface, but decays away very quickly. And this is really the origin of really different sensors and different communication elements that are inspired by this principle. And we also talk about really the current trend of applying this really photon material interaction into different fields. You can really start to build something that is a fast optical switch, an imaging element, different sensing, really a test kit, and more recently rendering the index of refraction of materials so that it appears to be invisible to light or other kind of waves. So that really are all inspired by linking the microscopic response to the macroscopic motion of or equations of motion. Okay. So now, today, we would like to continue this picture about the microscopic transport theory, and we already covered the top four questions. Okay? How much energy or momentum per particle can we have? And what are the how many particles are going to take a particular energy? This is really the discussion about the density of state and the thermodynamics. And how fast do they move? How do they interact? Now we would like to wrap up by the last question, that is, how far can they travel before they start to collide to another particle and lose their original momentum and energy? And this is actually done in a pretty simple way. For example, if we just look at the problem of an ideal gas, and let's assume this ideal gas can be described by a simple hard sphere, hard particle. Okay, and we know it is really flying at a speed of 1,000 meters per second. We just talked about that. And it will travel a distance before it hit another particle and change their direction. Okay? So the information that we want to acquire here is the so-called length L, actually, which is the total length L divided by the number of collisions, okay, in this really long path. So average distance between collisions is the information we want to find out. And now the possibility of this particle or really gas atom to hit another one is really determined by the number of atoms or number of other carriers that you can find within a volume described by this path. Okay? So, let's say in the case of ideal gas, the total collision volume is traveled by this particle is really the whole length times the cross-sectional area, right? The cross-sectional area of the particle. And the within this volume, pi d squared times L, which is really a long tube, now zigzagged or folded in different ways, there are possible number of molecules, and this is determined by the density of molecules within this volume. Okay, so total number is n pi d square L. Okay, that's very simple. Now, how many times this particle really can change their direction? It is really just determined by a hard, basically hard sphere interaction. Without touching, they are free from each other. But once they touch, there is a change or a collision. So from that, we find that the mean free path that we're looking at is really just the number of particles within this path, which is L, the longer the total length divided by the number of particles within this volume. Okay, so we find that it is 1 over n times a cross-sectional area. Okay, this cross-sectional area has a unit of meter square. And n, the number density, is really the numbers per unit volume, right? So area divided by volume gives us a dimension of 1 over length, and this is really the dimension of mean free path we're obtaining. Okay, so for the case of really random typical gas, we are looking at a cross section area of individual atoms. This is about the size of nanometer squares. Okay, so this is clear. Now, how we estimate the number density of carriers? Now, in the case of ideal gas, if we assume they have really no interaction, completely no interaction between each other, except when they are really directly in contact. Now, we know from ideal gas, the law of ideal gas, that the pressure and the temperature of such a gas system is correlated by the number of particles available. Okay? Pressure. Actually, we will come back to this pressure issue later. You can see that PV equals to nRT is the original equations for ideal gas, right? Now, if you use n divided by v, basically the volume of this gas, now we find the number density. This is really the simple equation that we're talking about. So from that, we are able to find the so-called mean free path of an ideal gas. The mean free path of ideal gas is really directly proportional to temperature and inversely proportional to pressure, okay, of the system times really the cross-sectional area. Okay, so how significant it is, how long a particle can really travel before they hit each other. If we use atmospheric pressure as an example, now we find that the length at room temperature, the length of a collision at room temperature is typically about 300 nanometers. Okay, 300 nanometers. And this is really a dimension that is comparable to what we said about nanoscale, right? 300 nanometers is a very important length. Okay, for room temperature gas system, room temperature and atmospheric pressure. So if we want to increase the mean free path, in other words, if we want to make sure that this particle can travel long enough without really changing their momentum or losing their energy so effectively, then one way is to either reduce pressure, for example, in a lower pressure, in 1 torr or 1 millitorr, now the mean free path of this atoms or molecules can be further increased to, you know, centimeters or even longer. Okay. So this is really the first message we find over here. So the denser, okay, the denser the number of particles, okay, or carriers you have, then the shorter the mean free path, right? They are easier to lose the so-called coherence, and it basically this, you know, kind of coherent interactions between each other. Okay, this is what we want to know about mean free path. And if you do this estimation by yourself, you will find out the mean free path for typical phonons, okay, are really in the scale of a lattice. And the mean free path of molecules or atoms in a liquid is not more than 10 angstroms in room temperature. So they lose their coherence nature, or they lose their, you know, kind of quantum mechanical nature in a very, relatively very short length. Okay. This is what we have to know. Okay, and there are still effort actually to understand how this size really plays a role. And when we now set up a wall to the otherwise ideal gas, now we start to see that the contribution of the width of the dimension also come into play, because before this atom hit another atom in the chamber, they may start to hit the wall, and this really interaction or exchange energy of energy with the wall by itself can be considered as a collision, right? So the overall mean free path is now modified when you are measuring, for example, a flow of a gas inside a fluidic channel. Okay, because the dimension now matters with the wall. Okay, for example, in the early 90s, there are some debates about whether water or gas can display a completely different thermal capacity or heat thermal conductivity inside a fluidic channel. The data or the report scatters a lot. Yeah. Some says, oh, you can increase this conductivity by order of magnitude. Some says the completed the measurement is completely unstable and not reproducible. So the debate remained there until they finally understand this size and boundary effect is in place. That you cannot do a direct comparison until you set up really the same reference. Okay. So effective mean free path in this system is effectively shortened because now we have to take into consideration of the boundary effect. Right? So the overall length, overall collision also have to consider the collision from the wall. Now, with all those different five atoms, okay, energy, per carrier, the number of carriers at giving energy, how fast they travel, how long they travel, and how they interact. Now we start to build things together. So we know those different things, really message. The Boltzmann equation, density of states, energy of a carrier at different states, and now what we need to do is to really put them together in really like a bookkeeping form, okay, to do the right counting. For example, if we want to estimate the internal energy that is contained within the system, what we should do is really put energy at first place. We know this is what we want to estimate, and we want to know the number of, you know, carriers, okay, at this given energy state, and we use Boltzmann distribution, okay, at individual carriers, okay, and now you can see that depending on the type of system, depending on the shape or geometry of the system, you can change the conclusion, you can change the picture quite dramatically. So let's work on the very simple problem, okay? Let's talk about the so-called internal energy of photons. And this is a problem actually of importance to thermal radiation. Assume you put a metal particle inside a SEM chamber, and you heat an electron onto it, and they start to melt. But there is no really other energy carriers outside the particle. So the way this, you know, particle can dissipate heat is through release of photons. Okay, so we're looking at a problem of photon. And now, if we assume that this is a photon in the vacuum, we can really take this energy and momentum relationship. And we say this is the carrier is a photon which follows Boltzmann-Einstein distribution. So this is the term that we are considering. And the density of states, now without any confinement, follows omega squared d omega. Okay? How we do that? Remember, we have to go back to omega to k relationship. Okay? Let me erase this part. I want to make sure that you guys can follow this effectively. So, first, we have this in the three-dimensional system, for all possible case, we say that the density within a shell of the sphere is 4 pi k squared dk, right? And now we first change k to omega, and we obtain that based on really, actually, I forgot to put a V per volume. Okay, so first we change k to omega, and because this is a linear, so we know that k squared becomes omega squared. Okay, and dk has to change to d omega, and the additional thing that we need to add on to it is d omega dk. Right? So this is really also from the omega to k relationship, okay? The so-called dispersion relationship. So this is why we need to know the first thing if we want to consider the momentum and energy relationship between different particles. Okay? So you can double check, and I hope you'll get the same conclusion over here. Now, we put all the things together. We are measuring energy. So energy is in place in this equation. Okay. Now, the only thing you don't need to, the all the two other items do not need to be changed for most of time. Okay. If you measure momentum, you place momentum over here. If you measure average temperature, you put the temperature over here. So anything that is about the really the average of the system, now you put it inside this integral. total internal energy of photons. Okay, now let's take a look of how it shows up after this integral. So we find that now if we take an integral over all the possible energy states, okay, we have an integral that is proportional to omega to the cube, frequency to the cube, and there is a d omega. So after integration, you should have something that is omega to the fourth power. Okay, frequency to the fourth power. So how is this really verified? We know in the case of a thermal radiation, there is a famous law called Planck's law. Okay, the Planck's law tells us that if you draw a wavelength spectrum of the radiated heat, okay, you will find out a distribution, and the distribution, the peak of this distribution actually varies when you increase the temperature. Okay, so now if we just convert this distribution inside the integral to wavelengths from, again, frequency, now I convert it to wavelengths, okay, we will find that now it follows a 1 over lambda, or 1 over the wavelength to the fifth power. And this is exactly what you find in most of the textbooks in regarding heat radiation. Okay, thermal radiation tells you that this is the Planck's distribution. Okay, so now let's try to integrate this further. If we want to integrate it, and now we will be able to find out the dependence of the total internal energy with respect to temperature. And it turns out that now if we just do a simple switch using or basically change our variables using the relationship between this photon energy and the thermal energy, now we can move everything out of move everything out that is dependent on temperature out of the integral equation. Okay, so this is a constant, not independent of temperature, and all the rest is temperature dependence. And we find that the emissive power, which is really the internal power of photons that are radiating out at the speed of light, okay, is proportional to temperature to the fourth power. This is Stefan Boltzmann's law. And now it's easier to understand how heat is exchanged in between two relay systems of two temperature. Okay, now a system that is of a hot end is radiating out at a rate of this T to the fourth power, and the cold sample also is radiating, so we have to account for a backward radiation, and the net heat flux is really just the difference or exchange of these two. Okay, so this is about photon. Okay, you may say that, I don't have to use photon most of time. So now let's try to look at photons. The reason I'm proposing photon as a beginning example is the mass is easier. Okay, you can really work out this for all possible dimensions and geometries. But now let's look at photon. Actually, it turns out the change is rather slim, because in terms of photon energy, we see that there is also a relationship of frequency to momentum, k. Okay? And Boltzmann distribution is the same, or actually still Boltzmann-Einstein distribution. And the density of states, we know if we use really the sine functions, then we still can find a solution. But Let me just take the simplest case of so-called Debye approximation, which again linearize the dispersion. Okay, we use this linearized dispersion. Now we say that the density of states of phonons, like photons, are omega square dependence. Okay, it's very important. Why is it important? We will see immediately. So now you put all things together, you will be able to find out really the total internal energy within this crystal. And this 3N is really describing the total number of atoms or really ions in the lattice that are contributing to this vibration. Okay? So now, you don't use total internal energy that often, but there is always a need to, for example, measure the so-called specific heat capacity. Here, if we take a derivative of the total internal energy of the system with respect to temperature, and we see that the previous integral is very similar to what we had for photons, which shows a T to the fourth power dependence. And now I take a derivative of this, I find a T to the cube dependence. Okay? T to the cube dependence. So this is really different from the original assumption that if phonons are all participating in the, you know, really heat conduction or heat transfer, then we should have all the modes that are giving you a constant, okay, specific heat capacity. This is not the case. We are observing a T to the cube dependence for most of really covalent bond solid. Okay, there is a T to the cube dependence, particularly when the temperature is relatively low. Okay? This is not that surprising yet. If we start to chop this material to different dimensions, the conclusion is even more surprising, because now we start to change the density of states. Right? Convert diamond to a very thin sheet of graphene. We lose the third dimension. And remember, now for two-dimensional case, we should have 2 pi k decay dependence, because the third dimension is discrete. Right? You only can have discrete energy levels, but in the plane direction, you are still allowed to really assign arbitrary values of k. So from now, we can convert it to the frequency dependence. Okay, now become omega instead of omega square. So in the case of every thin film graphene, or maybe nanotubes or carbon nanotubes or nanowires, now you start to see deviation from the previous prediction, because internal energy is now closer to T to the third power. And the capacitance, heat capacitance, is now T square dependence. Okay, and in case of nanoparticles, okay, in the case of nanoparticles, we say that there will be only discrete energy states available. So we now are only counting individual really vibrational modes instead of continuous modes. And from that, we find there is, again, a further deviation, which is really more complex shape of the temperature dependence. And this deviation of all this internal energy and capacitance are being reported in different systems, silicon nanowires, carbon nanotubes, graphenes, graphites, or you name it, of different geometries, and even clusters, which are really nanoparticles, below 50 nanometer in dimensions. This is the reason you see a large, really, a variation about a thermal, really, behavior at nanoscale. Okay, so you can change density of state, and the way you change density of state impact the really the heat capacity. Okay, so. This is probably, again, still not something that you have been using for a while. But now let's look at transport, conduction, okay? Because conduction will make use of heat capacity. So, for example, we are really interested in really estimating how much heat can be transferred from the hot end and to the cold end, now using different carriers or using different particles. And we are really counting on how they exchange and interact at different interfaces. Okay, so now let's just look at the simplest picture. If we want to estimate the energy transferred across any given, for example, interface between the hot end and the cold end, okay? Now let's try to count the number of particles that are coming from the, for example, the cold end to the hot end, and the number of particles that are coming from the hot end to the cold end, okay? You learn from really fluid mechanics that the total energy or total momentum transferred is really just the net flux of these two, right? So now let's try to do the counting. So from the cold end, we can say that we are looking at a plane that is approximately z plus lambda LZ. This LZ being the mean free path, okay? So why I'm picking up LZ? Because after that, there will be more collisions and to take place. So we are only interested in a net transport across this system without worrying about the interactions yet. Okay. So this is a net counting. So now, if we look at this and we count the energy, we say this is the internal energy at a plane that is z minus LZ, flying through this interface at a speed of VZ, right? And we take, because this is actually a completely symmetrical system, we take a half of this, okay? The energy is radiating out from this plane to all positive and negative z directions. Okay, so you want to count half of this. And now it is compensated by the cold end, which has a negative flux. Okay? Now, let's take a simple Taylor's expansion, because this LZ is assumed to be small. We know this is about, even for ideal gas, it's about 0.3 microns. For atoms or molecules, it's even angstroms. Okay, so we say this LZ is very small compared with the macroscopic behavior or system that we're looking at. So we take a Taylor's expansion. We will use U of Z minus LZ approximately U of Z plus LZ partial U partial Z, right, at location Z. So this is what we are looking at. Now if I do that, I will immediately find that the net flux at this plane is VZ LZ times the difference, okay, the spatial difference of the internal energy measured. And now let's do a little better counting, considering this all the possible directions available, because we want to convert VZ back to V, which is measured thermodynamically. Okay, so let's use a solid angle, and we say this solid angle along the top half plane can be as simple as sine theta d theta d phi. This is a small, really, a surface area that we're looking for. And we want to do also the same thing for velocity. Okay, velocity z projected onto the z direction is really just a cosine theta dependence. So by doing this, VZ and LZ now are mapped back to this equation of flux. Q heat flux is VL, okay, cosine square theta, again with a minus sign of the energy difference. Okay? The last bit of integration is it's lengthy, but I hope you will work through by yourself also. So the conclusion is now we have to really average out for all the possible solid angles in this half plane, okay? And we find an average of 1/3. Okay, so this is a flux. Okay, the flux gives us 1/3 of V, the velocity of the particle, L, the mean free path of the particle without being, you know, colliding to each other, and the difference in internal energy. And now we do the last conversion. This internal energy is not a very easy measure, so we convert it back to the thermal conductivity or thermal capacitance. So take a derivative with respect to T, and we measure really the temperature gradient instead. So we find that the net flux is a function of thermal capacitance, the velocity of particle traveling through this, and the mean free path of it. Okay, so this is the traditional Fourier's law of thermal conductivity. If you replace this gradient, you know, to really basically a more three-dimensional form, you see this is the thermal conductivity description. Thermal conductivity in this particular case is measured by capacitance, velocity at which it travels, and the number or the you know, average length at which it can travel. Okay. So, what is the insight from here? The insight from here is that now, if we change in our system, if we are able to change any one of them, we are able to change the thermal conductivity. Right? We are able to change thermal conductivity. If we shorten this length, we are going to lower thermal conductivity. If we are able to move the particle faster, we are going to increase the thermal conductivity, and vice versa. Right? So this is really the engineering side. We can really do a design, you know, from principles to change the way the system behaves. Okay? And why it is important? Because nowadays we are already running at the limit of, you know, the powers of, for example, Intel chips. Okay? They are getting closer and closer, and the amount of heat generated per each computing element is getting higher and higher. Okay, so if there is no way to dissipate the heat out, then, you know, before you start to compute something, you are really cooking the chip by itself. In fact, you can really cook an egg. I think you can really broil an egg if you do just a very simple browsing or some matrix multiplication. Okay, the temperature of the chip is more than 80 degrees on the surface, and just imagine if you double the capacity of the computing element inside. This heat dissipation is becoming a big issue. That's the reason there are a tremendous effort trying to really understand thermoconductivity and engineer that. So, likewise, we can do similar things for other laws, for other really transport equations that are involved, as we will do, as we will really practice later. And before we really call off for today's lecture, I encourage you to take a look of Professor Eric Popp's lecture. Okay, he has a website. His class is called Hot Chips, Atoms to Heat Sinks. That is, really a further developed version of how heat management is controlled in this nanoscale. Okay, and for more background materials, you can read this chapter one again on Compass website. Any questions? If not, I think we are right on time.